Hey, weirdos and queerdos, and welcome to another episode of Attention Confidential, the podcast where we explore self-awareness, curiosity, and advocacy in a safe container. I am your host, Maggie Green, here to remind you your voice matters and your stories are safe here.
In support of safety, please be advised that this podcast contains explicit language and direct or indirect references to material which some listeners may find triggering. Topics are highly personal and intimate, likely to touch on themes including but not limited to abuse, bigotry, body image, disability, mental health, sexuality, and trauma. Please prioritize your safety and the safety of those around you who may be exposed to this material, especially young folks. Please also note this is an ongoing project, which means I am actively engaged in learning while creating. The format, the tools, and skills to produce this material are all new to me. As I build and refine, I ask that you understand there may be kinks along the way. Awkward edits, background noise, all of those things. And because transparency is one of my core values, I should also share that I am using software that includes enhanced features to simplify the editing and post-production process. Any editing of this content, however, this original, organic, human-generated content, is done so at my discretion, specifically to optimize sound quality, not to manipulate, omit, or alter any substantive material in the recordings.
Okay, folks, I wanted to start by sharing some clarification, specifically around language. Language is something that's going to come up throughout the season. It's important to me, something that I pay really close attention to. And as I was working through editing and post-production, reflecting on these conversations, I noticed a specific word that I wanted to call attention to, and that word is backdrop. For any fellow drama and theater kids out there, when you hear or see the word backdrop, you might, like myself, think of set building, right? The giant physical backdrops designed to set the stage for a theater production, some kind of performance. I use the word backdrop in reference to what was unfolding around me, literally outside of my vehicle as I embarked on this journey. I also shared that this was much more than a road trip. It's still an active presence in my life. I am still learning from the experience, processing everything that happened, not only inside the vehicle and in conversations with the folks that I visited, but also what was happening outside, as in what is happening in this country and around the world along this specific timeline. So my point of clarification is this: what is happening right now, what will be happening over the next several years in the United States and around the world is not a backdrop. I want to acknowledge here for the record, these events, what is unfolding around us in our lives, is a living, breathing, ever-evolving nightmare. Now, one of the core tenets of tragic optimism is not to dismiss or ignore or minimize reality. Rather, we must stay aware, sit with discomfort, and move through it with the hope and knowledge that things will eventually get better. I have to tell myself that. I have to tell you that. We have to believe that if we are going to get through this. Some days, hope is all we've got. Y'all, the Tragic Optimist Tour was a reminder, a personal reminder for me to not lose hope. Hope is what kept me alive in some of the scariest, most violent, most traumatic moments of my life. Hope gets me out of bed on my darkest days. Even if it's just a tiny little nugget, there's still that glimmer of hope, and that's what keeps me going. Even amidst the terror and the trauma, the senseless acts of violence against vulnerable people, we have an opportunity to connect or reconnect with ourselves and each other. I want to remind you that wherever you are in this moment, however you're feeling, know that you're not alone. I'm going to share some things that I've not ever disclosed publicly. These are aspects of my own lived experiences that have made me feel alone, isolated, broken, defective, disconnected, Now, I'm going to do my best to tie it all together with what I experienced on the Tragic Optimist tour, but also know, while the tour may be over, the journey still continues. My journey, our journey as fellow human beings. Much of what was unlocked in my brain and my heart through my travels across the country and into Canada, which you'll hear about a little bit later in this episode. I think I'm ready to talk about that. Much of what was unlocked for me brought to the surface even more questions than answers. I'm not going to pretend like I have everything figured out, or anything for that matter. I know a thing or two about a thing or two. I'm human, doing the best that I can with the resources and the knowledge that I have right now. We all are, aren't we? So part of the beauty of that is the ongoing chance to learn and grow. The other part of that is the acceptance for where we are right now. As we move into the mirror segment, all about self-awareness, self-reflection, I was thinking what would be the most challenging note to start on. And I thought about this concept of worst first. Fellow neurodivergent folks will probably relate to that. What's the hardest? Get it out of the way. So when I'm thinking about self-awareness, self-reflection in the context of this trip, the worst first for me is my relationship with money. I'm a small business owner. Obviously, money comes up in conversation a lot. In my first few years of this business, I was inexperienced with sales and putting myself out there, pitching myself, convincing someone of my inherent value, let alone, you know, that which corresponds with a specific price tag. It was really difficult. It's still difficult. Budget is my least favorite part of any conversation, and it's an important one to have. We live in a capitalist society. Money makes the world go round. At least that's what we're taught, right? So for the mirror segment, I want to talk about it in general, as far as what I've learned, what I've observed, models that were part of my life growing up. And I also want to talk about how that impacted the trip. So before I get into all of that, I want to share something I've noticed when I think about other business owners and the way in which they're portrayed or displayed for public view. I don't see a lot of business owners talking about their financial situation. And there's a reason for that. We are raised, we're taught to not talk about money, that it's impolite or rude. And I think that's really interesting because money plays such a huge role in our lives. We're in the pursuit of it because it is tied to our livelihoods, our survival. It costs money to do just about anything. Costs money to have anything. We're not seeing a lot of business owners talking about it because we've been taught that it is inappropriate, unprofessional. One of the consequences of that is we don't really get a full picture of what it is like behind the scenes for a business owner, for someone that is channeling their passions, what they care about, what they're really good at, the impact that they want to have on this world, the communities around them. I think it's easy to assume that they've got it all figured out, that all their bills are paid, that they're not struggling, that it's easy. I also want to acknowledge it is absolutely a privilege to have been given the opportunity to start a business, to learn and grow and have that experience and all that it entails. I quit my job at the beginning of the pandemic and basically bet it all, what little I had, on myself, having the confidence and the drive and the belief that I could make an impact. I could grow something from nothing. The truth is, I am struggling.
Certainly not all business owners are going to relate to this, right? Not all small business owners even. But I would say the people for whom this might resonate are ones who are approaching business in a radically different way than what we are taught is, you know, the path, the playbook, particularly regarding core values and ethics, and how we approach, you know, the capital aspect. Thinking about this idea, anti-capitalism, post-capitalism, it feels like a luxury to even have the space and the time to reflect on those ideologies and philosophies. You know, there are probably a lot of people out there want to turn their passion into something that will support them. I won't say it's not possible, but I certainly have not cracked the formula yet. It has been a continuous learning and development and growth period for me to figure out what this business needs to look like for my sanity, for my conscience, for that alignment, and also balance that with the capital demands of this environment. So I wonder if other small business owners out there, ethical micro business owners, are facing similar challenges. For example, you know, I do come from a marketing background. I really love data, critical thinking, and analysis, and it is the smart and necessary business thing to do to engage in strategic planning, explore and pursue data-driven results, data-driven decision-making. So beyond year one, I had a full set of data to kind of analyze to educate me and inform decisions about what are the things I should be doing more of, what are things that maybe aren't working that I had hoped they might, doing that analysis. And it's interesting where I sit today. You know, I offer no interest monthly payment plans. There are no financial penalties for breach of contract with clients. I approach my business with people before profit. And I think there's been some conflation in my mind, perhaps due to financial wounds in the past. People before profit doesn't mean people instead of, in lieu of. It's people first, but not people only, right? The profit piece is very important. I'm not a nonprofit. I'm not a charitable organization. I'm a human. I am a taxpaying citizen. I have financial responsibilities and needs to be met. So I'm looking at my reports year over year, and I'm doing my best to reconcile and negotiate. Data tells me the money is in this direction and in these activities, but the people are pointing me in a different direction. It's a difficult balance. Is the money important? Yes. Is it the most important thing? No. But if you ask the conventional business owner, if you ask corporate executives, if you ask marketers in the world, what's the most important thing? You know, it is that bottom line. And that's really tough. Maybe I'm not cut out for entrepreneurship. And I've definitely been studying on that lately and exploring some answers to those tough questions. So we'll see. I absolutely still have hope. And it is definitely to a critical point where if I am to realize any kind of financial future for myself, I'm not even talking retirement. I fully plan to work until I physically cannot anymore. Who knows what that timeline looks like? But for the time being, I need to make sure that my needs are met and, you know, the data doesn't lie. As far as the trip goes, I wanted to share a little bit of insight about that relative to my relationship with money, managing finances, and making those types of decisions. I was reflecting on scarcity and how most of my experiences with travel have been guided by scarcity. So knowing that I had credit to rely on, that I was fully confident in my ability to repay that debt, knowing that I had that as a resource meant that I did not have to go into this situation as if it were scarce. Now that didn't mean it was like spare no expense. I'm not that kind of person. I'm low maintenance, low budget, thrifty. I try to be conservative as far as that goes. But just knowing that, like, if I wanted a snack, if I needed to book another night at a hotel, that was an option to me. I was thinking about resources, about scarcity, and I thought it was kind of cute. I wrote down, I'm by no means rolling in it, but I'm definitely ready to roll. I felt resourced. There's a bit of cash in my pocket. I had a tiny bit of savings and obviously that credit card to rely on. So I felt like I had what I needed to make this a good experience and not be so concerned and preoccupied with money, like the environment that I grew up in. Felt like sometimes that's all they fucking talked about. So since returning, the situation is a little bit different. There were some unplanned expenses associated with the trip. I didn't fully plan for everything. I had set a budget of $3,000 and ended up spending closer to $4,000. A couple of major things. One was related to Canada. I'll tell you all more about that a little bit later. My travel companion shouldered some of the financial burden for our shared parts of the trip. They were extremely generous and kind to help furnish gas, for example, meals. They paid for several of the lodging spaces, which was really helpful. The other major expenses were equipment. I purchased it secondhand, the equivalent of like a full mobile recording studio, microphones, and all of the accoutrement, including external storage and SD card. I also needed a new laptop, because mine was over 5 years old and well on its way to perishing, did not have the capacity to operate the software that I needed, did not have the space to accommodate the files of the size that I needed to produce the podcast. So those were pretty big business expenses. This was a project. This was work. And of course, my work is super personal.
If you're a small business owner, if you are working through this right now, if you are struggling, I see you, I feel you, and I absolutely know what it's like. On paper, this business is not viable. I am actively seeking full-time employment to supplement my income. The business is not enough to sustain me. It's not enough to carry my share of the financial load in my household, and we've reached a breaking point. I am feeling insecure, stressed about finances. I've gone through periods of feeling like a failure. I have debated whether or not to close the business, and I really hate starting on that note, but I want to be forthright and transparent with you all. I want to tell you what it's really like. I can't tell you how many notifications I've received from my bank with an overdraft notice or insufficient funds where an auto payment had been processed, but the funds were not in the account to support it. I am regularly moving funds from my business account to my personal account to make sure that those expenses are covered. I'm making payments on my credit card. We'll talk a little bit about credit. I wanted to start by kind of painting a picture of where I'm at right now. I think it's really easy to assume we've all got our shit together, and that's just not true. I know that not only from personal experience, but in conversations with other business owners, this is not something that's talked about. When I think back from early childhood into adolescence and adulthood, money was always a topic of conversation. It was always the barrier between my family and our needs, a barrier between things that I wanted to do or experience and not getting to do those things because money was something we didn't have a lot of. And there was always that awareness, and it was sort of baked into my psyche from early on. We're not even operating at the minimum. My family was below the poverty line. Ironically, I'm in one of the most expensive areas of the country right now. It is an uphill battle. I do have my basic needs met. I have a roof over my head, a fridge full of food, plenty of clothing. That was not always the case. I grew up in intense scarcity. Something that may surprise you all, I grew up working on tobacco farms as young as 7 years old, and I worked every single summer until I was 12 in the hot-ass tobacco fields. My job was to follow the tobacco setter. So, open field, there's a tractor pulling an attachment that a couple of people are operating to put the plants in the ground. My job was to carry a handful of tobacco plants, and any time the setter missed a plant, I'd pull from the handful that I had and replace that plant. Hours and hours, miles in the hot sun behind this tractor, putting those tobacco plants on the ground. At the end of the summer, I got paid. That didn't happen all the time. I didn't always get paid, but when I did, I will never forget, for 2.5 months, of work. And I remember that $75 check. It was like, oh my gosh, this is so much money. And I was thinking about all the different things that I might want to purchase. At the time, it was cassette tapes or office supplies. I was always really excited about new pens and pencils. A family member that I lived with insisted that part of that check go to supporting the household. And whatever money was left over is what I had to spend on myself. I lived in an abusive household, and the matriarch of the family, he took control of that money and dictated where it went. So what little money I made, I didn't even get to enjoy. But I was obligated to do that work, to help my family, to earn my keep. That's definitely a money wound. I worked really hard as a child and into my teens at different, you know, food service jobs, minimum wage. I did what I could to contribute to my family, and it was really hard because I wasn't really taught how to manage my money or how to think about the future or what a budget was or anything like that. My parents were divorced, and my father notoriously did not pay child support. He was imprisoned multiple times for failure to pay child support. We were on welfare. Food stamps were a regular part of my life, not only growing up. I was on food stamps the year I moved to Seattle. Even with food stamps growing up, sometimes that was not enough. Most of the time, that was not enough. There was never a period when I was not on the free lunch program, and thinking about that program being demolished and destroyed right now makes me sick to my stomach. I mentioned food stamps, credit. I think it's important to talk a little bit about my mom. Her relationship with money was definitely fraught. She grew up in a culture with a family that taught that women needed men to survive. Men were the breadwinners. The men were the workers, and women stayed at home to raise the children and manage the domestic responsibilities. And while those things were not directly instilled in me, I observed the internalization of that through my mom's behavior. She was all the time applying for credit cards and maxing them out. I was afraid to have a credit card. One of my earlier jobs since moving to Washington required us to pay for travel expenses and request reimbursement. One of those travel expenses was a hotel site for a client event, and I didn't have a credit card. They would not accept a debit card or cash, and so I ended up asking my boss if he could put it on his credit card. Credit cards were scary to me. I didn't want to make the same mistakes my mom did. I was afraid I would be susceptible to those same kind of behaviors. I didn't have the education or understanding of the credit system that I do now. She filed for bankruptcy multiple times. Eventually, the legal system took action against my father and obligated him to pay out back child support. There was a lump sum awarded to my mother, and I don't remember seeing any of that money. It went directly to paying the rent, basic necessities, utilities, keeping the lights on. But there was also mismanagement, if not abuse of funds. My mother was an alcoholic, and so sometimes that money was used to buy beer. I remember going to food banks with my mom, and there was a lot of shame and fear and insecurity, a lack of dignity having to go. When I was a senior in high school, starting to think about college, which I didn't even think was a possibility. You know, you have to file your FAFSA, right? And up to that point, my mom had been claiming me as a dependent on her taxes. The only way to get the full financial benefit with Pell Grant and scholarships was to be financially independent. Felt like it was completely out of reach for me. I learned a little bit more, spoke with the school guidance counselor to figure out if it was even going to be possible. And I learned that what would make it possible was, again, financial independence. I did not have an income at the time. And my mom not claiming me on her taxes would have been a direct benefit to me. So I begged her at 17 years old to please not claim me so that I can be recognized as financially independent. This is the only way I'm going to get into college, the only hope I have. Fortunately, it worked out. I found a school that offered full tuition scholarships to low-income students. The car I have now is my first car, what I consider my first car. It's the one that I actually purchased, financed directly off of a used car lot. The vehicle that I had previously was financed by the generosity of a family member. I worked to pay that back over a couple of years. The vehicle I had before that was a hand-me-down, which I'm really grateful for. Transportation is such a barrier for so many people, and I did have access to that. And I've not been without a vehicle, except for about a year when I first moved out here from Kentucky. I remember the first big purchase I made for myself. It was at a peddler's mall, a freestanding mirror with a wooden frame. And I remember panicking and debating, like, can I afford this? Should I do this? Do I deserve it? I really wanted it. So I spent $100 on a mirror. We have a bit of debt that we're trying to overcome right now. The largest part of that was an unexpected expense. Our water heater died last fall, and we had to finance a replacement, and we're still working to pay that off. I should say, too, home ownership is a bit of a misnomer. I don't feel like I own this land. I'm beholden to a bank because of the mortgage. Before I quit my job and started the business, I had enough of a financial track record of stability that a lender was willing to give me a loan, which is amazing. I didn't think that would ever happen. All of the maintenance and repair are now our responsibility, my responsibility. And I remember when the water heater went out last fall, this is still kind of a tender topic because in the moment, I lost my shit. I was like, this is the end. Because had that happened any other time in my life, it would have been game over. Financial devastation. We would have had to foreclose on the home, hang it up, and try to start over. And I remember panicking. And my partner said, it's just money. It's just money. I don't even understand that concept. Still to this day, just money. Again, it is the barrier. The price of admission where it is what stands between me and making sure my needs are met, stands between me and getting what I need and what I want, helping others. I would love to be able to donate regularly to causes that I care about, but I can't afford it. So, yeah, taking the risk to finance the trip on my credit card was an investment in myself and in my business. It might be tough for a while, but it's worth it. I really wanted the experience. I felt like I needed to connect and reconnect with people, not in spite of, but because of the challenges we're collectively experiencing as humans. I felt afraid. It's like I felt afraid when the pandemic happened. It was like, what if the world ends? What do I want to be doing? What have I not done? With whatever time I have left, what do I want to be doing? When I was thinking about my 5-year business anniversary, I thought, how do I want to honor this milestone? And this was it. I really wanted to meet people where they were and interact with them in their element. And it was scary all to bank on myself in that way. And having a credit card to rely on as a resource meant I could fill my tank up when I needed to. It meant booking lodging was not an issue. It also meant in case of emergency, there was an amount available to me if something happened.
Fortunately, there were no emergencies. The biggest surprise expense was a $500 fine. Also, you know, in support of proactive self-care, made an unplanned investment while on the road. Right before the halfway mark, I was feeling depleted physically. It was a lot of driving, lack of sleep, kind of weird meal schedules, and a shit ton of activity. And so I have a friend who has a mobile med spa that does therapeutic IV injections. So, you know, hydration was really important. I was hydrating, but not enough. So I knew medical grade saline would definitely be helpful. Also a cocktail of different vitamins to help boost immunity, kind of bring my body back after some of the stress I had put it through. I think without that investment, I might not have physically been able to withstand the second half of the trip. So it was absolutely worth every penny. I won't say the same about the fine. Moving into the magnifying glass segment, the next kind of logical step here is to talk about my relationship with travel that ties into some of the insights I've shared about my relationship with money and finances. Again, I think it is time to finally rip that Band-Aid off and tell you all about Canada and why it was such a big deal, the specific place I visited, and what that meant for me.
Attention Confidential is sponsored, produced, and distributed by Self Magnitude LLC, an ethical microbusiness on a mission to transform how you see yourself. It is hosted by Maggie Green, personal brand and style strategist for weirdos and queerdos of all ages and gender expressions, who is also the face and voice behind Self Magnitude, helping people feel seen since 2020. If you're looking for support on embodying all aspects of your identity and showing up as your radically authentic self in person, in print, and online, please visit Maggie's 100% DIY website at selfmagnitude.com.
Particularly because this is so early on in the season, I think it will be helpful to lay some foundation and context about my relationship to travel. There is the space and time in which the Tragic Optimist tour unfolded in April of 2025, and a lifetime of travel-related experiences that really shaped my understanding and feelings about travel. Any other time I've traveled, it was always on someone else's timeline, someone else's budget. There were other constraints. I hadn't done much travel at all just for myself. So I want to share where I am coming from regarding travel and what that was like. Some of the things that I've learned when I think about childhood as it relates to travel, I think about field trips. If you went to public school, you probably remember there was always like a permission slip you had to sign, and a lot of times there was a fee. Right? It paid for your brown bag lunch, your share of transportation. I do remember a few field trips, but more than the trips themselves, I remember the stress and anxiety around what it took to be able to participate. So if there was an extra cost, most of the time I was not allowed to go because money was the barrier. In the cases where I was allowed to go, it was because we were able to find a family member to sponsor the cost of that experience. Any extracurricular activities and things like that, band, drama, had associated expenses like instruments and uniforms. I didn't participate in sports, no extracurricular activities, because there was that extra cost on top of whatever fuel it took to get me back and forth. So that was not a part of my life. I think about vacations. The only ones that I really remember were sponsored by a family member who sort of brought me into the fold, like an add-on, an accessory for an already planned vacation. There were other travel experiences that were called vacations or marketed to us as vacations that were not. I was in seventh grade. My mother had just gotten divorced and there was some financial settlement. So she had a lump sum that she chose to spend on a trip. Took my brother and I on a quote unquote vacation to England. For some context, I often refer to my mom as an internet dating pioneer. This was mid to late 90s. She was actively involved in that. To kind of tie it back to the mirror segment about money, she was always looking for a man. A man meant security, stability, financial health. And so she drug us along for that experience. When I was in college, my brother had gotten out of the military. I was living in Kentucky. He and I came up with this idea for a road trip. We wanted to go back and visit Florida, where I graduated high school, had a lot of friends and really close connections. And so he and I took a road trip from Kentucky to Florida. It was a bit of a financial crunch, but we had what we needed. The year after I graduated college, I was working on an organic vegetable farm, and one of my fellow apprentices on the farm and I took a long weekend and drove to Nashville.
Just for some context, this was peak 2008 economic crisis, working
on an organic vegetable farm, we were making literally $100 a week. We also were responsible for providing our own groceries, and we had to pay for water to be hauled in. The Nashville trip was sponsored in part by a family friend of my fellow apprentice. We stayed with a friend's parents there. They hosted us and took us out to eat and showed us a really good time. But we were roughing it.
Other than that, there were no road trips until I moved from Kentucky to Washington.
That trip was a sordid experience. I had sold my hand-me-down car for the trip. My brother and I pooled all of our money together, and he was camp finance director. In retrospect, I wish I had kept those funds separate, because at some point in California, the funds had run out, and I was unaware of that, and we actually ended up stranded for a couple of days while we waited for one of his buddies to wire us some cash to get to our final destination. Lesson learned there, for sure. He obviously grew up in the same environment I did. Both of us have struggled with budgeting and just money management. That's well over 10 years now. We've grown up a lot in that time.
My partner and I took a road trip from Washington to Kentucky so that he could meet my family. Since that time, 2018, I haven't really traveled anywhere recreationally. Did a couple of work trips, went to Edmonton, Alberta, Long Beach, California. Growing up, we moved a lot, going between Kentucky and Florida, back to Kentucky, back to Florida. My mom had a close friend in Florida who was kind of our lifeline, our support network when things were not working out in Kentucky, when things were not working out in Florida. My mom's safe space was Kentucky. It was our home. We always went back there. With each of those moves, it was really chaotic and stressful. It felt as if we were fleeing. You know, my mom was ready to get us out in a hurry. And I remember her saying, "You have one cardboard box and you need to decide right now what's going in that cardboard box. Everything else we have to leave." Every time we moved, it was always on a tight timeline and an even tighter budget. We didn't have anything. We were trying to get to somewhere where someone could help provide resources. Tragic Optimist Tour, part of the inspiration for that was, can I repair or change my feelings about traveling? And when I was thinking about the places that I might want to visit, the people I might want to visit, I saw an opportunity to take that a step further, to revisit a really painful destination associated with trauma in my past, Canada. So I'm going to tell you about Canada relative to the Tragic Optimist Tour, but I think it's really important to share a little bit about Canada historically for me, specifically Nova Scotia.
Before I can really talk about Canada, I need to go back to England just briefly. I've never said this out loud before, but I was sexually assaulted in England. An older man, mid to late 40s, the husband of the couple that my mom had befriended online that we were visiting while we were there, touched me inappropriately in broad daylight while we were out in public with their family and my family. Again, my mom was an internet dating pioneer. I mentioned that she was raised in a culture that said you had to have a man. You had to be looking for a man if you didn't have one. And finding one and locking one in was the key to longevity, stability, security. She wasn't necessarily looking for a relationship when she found this man in Nova Scotia. They spoke online, had phone calls for several weeks, and my mom decided to go and meet him in person. My brother and I took that to mean she'll come back, right? So we stayed with her friend in Florida, who had children about our age, lived with them off and on. 2 months went by. We're in regular contact, but we have no idea when or if she's coming back. So my 13th birthday in February comes and goes, and we're headed into spring season. And my mom says that she wants to fly my brother and I up for a visit. She said, "I really want you to meet this man. He also has a roommate. I think you'll really like her. You know, come and hang out for a week, and then we'll all come back together. If I'm not ready to leave, I'll come back when I'm ready." but I really want you all to be here for spring break. So we went, and we were supposed to be there for 5 or 7 days. And like 2 days before our anticipated departure, my mom sits us down and says she did not purchase return tickets, that we would be staying. We were not going back home to Florida. We would be in Nova Scotia for over a year, a total of 14 months. Because we were not citizens, we had no legal rights or access to resources, so we were kind of in hiding. My mom was not able to work because she was not legally, technically allowed in the country past the 6 month mark. My brother and I were minors, so it was not a possibility for us to get jobs. We spent a lot of our time exploring, walking around, totally unsupervised. And in that process, I did manage to make some friends. I even dated for part of the time that we were there. It wasn't all bad, but there was a lot of manipulation, psychological and emotional abuse, financial abuse. While my mom had come into that situation with some money, she had sold her car to finance part of that trip. This was, I want to say, less than a year back when we went to England. So she had burned through the divorce settlement. She got a car in the settlement and sold the car and used part of those proceeds to go to Canada. And that is what we lived on until it ran out. Then we were completely dependent on this man and his roommate. Getting out into the community, trying to make friends, any kind of social contact was a means of survival. Without that, I don't know if I would have made it through without completely losing my mind. I befriended a lesbian couple. I would often spend weekends and several nights throughout the week over at their apartment. They had lots of cats and dogs, and we had a lot of shared interests. We liked the same music and movies, and we got along really well. I grew very close to these people. I shared what was going on at home. Both of them had experienced some amount of trauma in their childhood and could relate, kind of took me under their wing. I was 14 years old. These women were 19 and 20. I have not named this publicly, and only in trusted, intimate, personal circles have I shared that I also experienced assault in Nova Scotia. One of the women, one night, pushed me up against the sink in a karaoke bar and kissed me. Without consent. It was confusing, but mostly it made me feel gross. I felt sick, also deeply disappointed because she betrayed our friendship by asking me to keep quiet, to not tell her girlfriend. That ate me alive for weeks, and I finally had to absolve myself. I sat them both down to clear the air, which caused some drama, not gonna lie. After some time, the fallout kind of settled a bit, and they welcomed me back to their home, where they gifted me some Swiss chocolate, presumably as an olive branch. Turns out it was a laxative they had disguised as Swiss chocolate. They took the time to unwrap the foil wrapper and buff off the logo and insignia from the individual pieces. I ate well over half a bar. You know, chocolate was such a rare treat anyway. I really felt special and cared for. I thought it was a sweet gesture. I got incredibly ill, and I was up all night in the bathroom crying from pain and also from the shame of having to use so much of their toilet paper. They were low income, limited resources. They were willing to kind of take me in and provide for me. They fed me, let me stay with them. When they got up the next morning, I apologized, oblivious to the fact that they had fucking poisoned me. And the harder I cried and begged for forgiveness, they just laughed louder. They'd done it on purpose to punish me for causing a rift in their relationship. Of course, I left immediately in shambles. I'm really sick. I probably should have gone to the emergency room, but that was a total liability and risk. We were not citizens, so that service was not available to us. The woman who kissed me called our apartment the next day and said she hoped I died on the way back to America and that I could not leave the country fast enough. It wasn't too long after that, a neighbor threatened to call immigration on us. My brother had gotten in a fight with her son, and she knew our situation, threatened to call immigration. So we hitched a ride under the cover of night with a friend of the man we'd been living with, and he dropped us and our giant garbage bags full of our stuff at a Dunkin' Donuts just over the border in Maine. Folks, when I tell you we were in the parking lot of that Dunkin' Donuts for almost 10 hours. It is no exaggeration. Without shelter, without resources, without money, apart from the pocket full of quarters that my mom had that she was using at the payphone to make calls to her friend back in Florida, trying to coordinate some kind of rescue mission to get us back home. The friend was able to coordinate with the local Red Cross to get us emergency shelter for the night. Through partnership with another service organization, we were also able to get Greyhound bus tickets sponsored. It's a lot of hours on Greyhound buses, but that was one of the longer trips. I thought a lot about that time spent in Dunkin' Donuts. We were helpless, had no idea where our next meal was coming from. We couldn't afford to get coffee. We were just hanging out in the parking lot. My mom would go in every hour or so to make another call. This was long before cell phones, long before mass access to the internet. Those were not things. We do get back to Florida eventually. Again, I'm 14 years old. So when we get back to Florida, I should have been entering my sophomore year had we not missed over a year of school. So by the time I returned to public high school, my graduating class was a year ahead of me. Fortunately, I learned about a program for working students to give them freedom and flexibility to work a part-time job and go to school. By entering into that program and doubling up on my junior and senior year, I took junior and senior AP English together, my math classes, science, all the general education requirements, instead of electives. I packed it in and was able to graduate high school in 3 years, which meant that I could walk the stage with my peers. At the time, that felt really important. I'll never get that time back. Those bad memories are still there. But as I was approaching the Tragic Optimist tour 25 years on, I thought this is an opportunity to revisit that place and perhaps replace those bad memories with good ones. We got to Halifax. My travel companion and I were greeted by a handful of clients, most of whom I had not ever met in person before, and none of whom had ever met each other. We got to spend a couple of hours hanging out in a private event space that one of my clients runs her business out of. Really cool space. We got to have a late night stroll around the waterfront, and the client that I mentioned, partner, kind of played tour guide for us and told us about all the cool sights and things happening around downtown. The same waterfront that I used to traverse to get to my friends, the lesbian couple's house across the harbor. It was a wildly different experience, only good memories. But to get to Nova Scotia, the only route is through New Brunswick. So in revisiting this place, Dunkin' Donuts, I had to put that on the itinerary. I wanted to go back and remind myself I'm in a different place now. I'm safe. I'm an adult. I have choices, resources. I can go in and get all the coffee and snacks I want. I don't have to spend any time in this fucking parking lot. Came back to that place and reclaimed it and felt mostly empowered, although there was some anxiety, some flashbacks happening, vivid memories of the past and all the time that we had spent in that parking lot, all the stress and just everything. Nova Scotia was fantastic, but the journey between Dunkin' and Halifax was fucking stressful. My travel companion, it's not lost on either of us. The dynamic in that moment. We're talking late April. Things were heating up between the U.S. and Canada, and we're trying to stay on top of the latest news and information to sort of brace ourselves for whatever might happen, including being rejected at the border or having to provide extra pieces of identification. We felt pretty prepared, but my internal experience was extremely chaotic and emotional. I was a nervous wreck, not thinking clearly apart from focusing on our safety to make sure I don't fuck up driving. I want to make sure to get us across the border. I felt like it was my responsibility. I had planned the trip. Also, I had been to Canada before, and it was my vehicle. I thought if I make it over this border, then I can have my emotional breakdown and take some space before I had to meet up with clients. My only frame of reference for border crossing was by plane, with the exception of a short trip I took to British Columbia a few years ago to hang out with another client. I was like, I know they're going to ask about customs. They're going to ask if we have anything to declare. Do we have seeds of any kind or plants? Do we have any food items, weapons, firearms? I fully expected to be asked those things. What's your purpose for the visit, right? So I answered all of those questions at the initial entry point, and the agent was cordial, upbeat even. He did have some questions about what was in the vehicle, and so I was taking a mental inventory, trying to think of all the different things that were in the car. I had packed for a 30-day trip, so I had everything. Food, clothing. I brought a Frisbee and a deck of cards and books and shoes. And I said, I think there might be a few beers in the cooler. And I remember the agent said, would you say it's more likely that there is beer in the cooler or more likely that there isn't? And I said, oh, no, there's a beer or two in there. But just getting like really into the weeds about the contents of my vehicle, which made me even more nervous. I said, you know, we don't have any weapons, but I had a pocket knife. Each of us had pepper spray. I had like a first aid kit with like an industrial tourniquet, recording equipment, flashlights. So I'm rattling off all these things. I did have some cigarettes for personal use. That was their big concern. Are you coming into the country to try to sell some shit? So we made it through that initial checkpoint and they said, pull over off to the side here, and then we were instructed to go inside the office where there were more border agents who had even more questions for us. They start the search in the vehicle where they're pulling all of the items out of the car and lining them up on the table, which we can see through the window just outside. And I realize that I had a stun gun. I had not declared that. And I thought, well, it's probably too late now. They're mid-search. They're going to find it. And I saw the facial expression of one of the agents who was searching the vehicle change. Her demeanor completely changed. I saw her pull the container that the stun gun was in and came in and had a completely different attitude towards us. Immediate suspicion. So she talks to one of her colleagues and the colleague calls me over and asks me a series of questions. First about the stun gun, which I said I had completely forgotten that was in the vehicle. I didn't intentionally fail to declare it. I simply forgot. It's not something that I usually carry. It was a gift from a family member who was involved in the assembly of my personal protection kit. I said it slipped my mind. Of course, they were even more suspicious. So they're asking me more about the trip, my history, my identity, who I am, what's my business. It was a full-on interrogation. They take my travel companion to a different location and interrogate them. Very intense 2-hour process. Like I said, they pulled every bit of stuff out of the car. Every little thing was piled out on this table and on display, and they combed through all of it. They did the same thing with who I am as a person, sort of deconstructed and dug and poked and prodded into my past, told me to name the different states that I had lived in.
I did not disclose that I had been to Nova Scotia as a teenager. Did not feel safe doing that.
They were doing research to validate and verify what I was saying. I ended up having to reach out to my partner with an SOS to share a photo of my social security card and another piece of mail to validate my address, because apparently my passport, my driver's license were not sufficient.
They asked me about my business. Funny anecdote, the border agent translated what I said into, so you're a life coach. And I was like, oh no, 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 please don't put that on my paperwork. I'm absolutely not a life coach. And I spent 5 years trying to explain to prospective clients, like, if that's what you're looking for, that is not my bag.
Ultimately, I was cited for attempted smuggling because of the stun gun. They seized my vehicle, and to get my vehicle released back to me, I had to pay a $500 fine.
I can laugh at it now, but in the moment, certainly, it was harrowing.
Anxiety brain got the best of me, and I will be working to forgive myself for the stress and potential trauma it caused my travel companion. I felt like I failed them. as soon as we got over the border, they actually did let us through. As soon as we got over the border, I was ready to leave Canada. I was like, I can't wait to get out of here.
I can't imagine what my travel companion must have been feeling, having to be interrogated formally by the Canadian government. They wanted proof that someone was going to be retrieving them, that there was no intention of either of us staying.
The return trip back into the United States was uneventful. The border agent did not even ask us if we had weapons in the car. It was a very quick, like, welcome back, have a safe trip. Now that I've been on the road and I've had this experience of travel by choice with resources, things are totally different. I can't wait for the next opportunity to travel. For a long time, I just told everybody I hated travel. I might take a short trip to visit a friend in the local area, but I'm not going to do any kind of substantial travel. Not interested in going overseas. I'm not interested in backpacking through Europe, like so many of the silver spoon fed trust fund kids out this way have done. I'm not interested in any of that. I am interested in human connection and being present as much as I can. Our final segment, the megaphone, the metaphorical soapbox. As I think about the things this trip brought up for me, I think the thing I want to shout most about is privilege. My mission for this trip was to connect with as many people as I could with the time that I had, and I fulfilled that mission. I also wanted to engage in mutual support, using whatever resources I could to make a positive impact. There's a flip side to that mission as far as mutual aid is concerned, being open to receive kindness and generosity. I grew up in poverty, in scarcity, abuse and trauma, manipulation and criticism, physical violence and emotional violence. I've worked really hard to break some of those generational cycles, to be aware, to hone my emotional intelligence and empathy. Those traumatic experiences helped strengthen those things. I'm able to relate to others in ways that maybe some people are not. And I want to acknowledge that I do have some amount of privilege, advantages that I've not specifically earned. I am white, cisgender, heterosexual passing, right? When I think about my trans and gender nonconforming siblings, when I think about the people of color, Black people I love dearly, would not have the same experience without the threat of harm, literal danger. The message really here is a call to action. If you find yourself in similar circumstances, you have an opportunity. The privileges that you have can be leveraged for good. I want to acknowledge, again, tying this back to the trip, I was keenly aware of the risks to my safety. I was afraid, but I was also cautious and well-resourced. But one of the things that comes to mind before I left for the trip, I had a collection of bumper stickers on my vehicle that were associated with advocacy and LGBTQIA+. Pride, trans pride. One of the bumper stickers I purchased from a friend who is trans and non-binary, vocal in the advocacy and social justice space with respect to trans issues. I felt good about supporting this person. Displaying that message on my vehicle felt like one way to be active in sending social signals that this is a safe space, I am a safe person. The language on that sticker had an undercurrent of violence, a bit, let's say, off-brand for me. The bumper sticker said, "There are girls with dicks and guys with vaginas and transphobes without teeth." There were a lot of people, close friends and family and colleagues, who expressed concern for my safety because of that bumper sticker. Now, I'm going to acknowledge I'm in Western Washington, in a bit of a cultural bubble here. I wasn't ignorant or oblivious to the potential for danger, but I was protected in some ways by where I live. And so going outside of that bubble meant that that risk for harm and danger was greater. And I understood that. Initially, I felt a little bit defensive and protective. You know, I shouldn't have to change how I look. I shouldn't have to change the way I show up to make sure that I am safe. And as I was having those thoughts and feelings, I thought, every person out there, every human who is not white, cisgender, heterosexual passing, also should not have to make those changes, but they do every single day to ensure their safety. Had a lot of conversations, and I really appreciated the thought and care that people put into supporting me in that way, caring whether or not I was confronted with physical danger or violence on this trip. Beyond that, I started doing some research, particularly within social justice advocacy and namely protesting community. What are the best practices? What are the things I don't know that I should be considering? By and large, the advice always is to blend in. There is more safety in not drawing attention to yourself than the alternative. You don't want to stand out. You don't want to be remembered. All of these things were in conflict with everything that I teach about personal branding. So it was a bit of an internal reckoning, like, but I want to take up space, right? I need to show up as my authentic self. And you know what? When it comes to life or death and personal safety, none of those rules apply. You absolutely have to do what you have to do to keep yourself safe. And one of those things was removing that bumper sticker. I stand by that decision. I also know the privileges I mentioned before and the absence of those messages on my vehicle made it easier for me, made it safer for me. I won't say I didn't worry about my safety traveling alone. A single woman is a target, a potential target. And I did worry about that.
Final deciding factor had nothing to do with my personal safety. It was about protecting the people I was visiting. Had I kept the bumper sticker on, parking at friends' and clients' homes and businesses would have drawn attention to them, put them in danger. They could have been targeted or harmed, and I couldn't risk that. Once those implications were clear to me, in combination with advice, of course, from trusted sources, scraping that thing off was as important, if not more important, than applying it to my car in the first place.
I also want to acknowledge that without support, this would not have been possible. So yes, I do have privilege, and I've worked really hard to get where I am. I've worked hard the last 5 years in this business to be able to celebrate that milestone. I don't know if I'll see 10 years. I don't know if I'm going to get through this year, but I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to keep showing up. I'm going to get involved where I can, support where I can, show up for the people who need support when and where I can. And I'm also going to remind myself, as I'll remind you all now, the idea is not to shame you about your privilege. It is about acknowledging it and being aware of it, the impact that it has on you, and how the absence of those things impacts the people around you. In this moment, this political, economic, cultural climate, that's more important than ever. So be aware of those things. And if you have capacity, if you have the resources, do what you can with those privileges to help lift others up.
The original music, as featured on Attention Confidential, was written, composed, and produced by Christopher Colley Biondi, a deaf pianist, composer, and dear friend in Central Kentucky, who generously provided his skills and talent to support the launch of this podcast. That's all for this episode of Attention Confidential, but of course the conversation doesn't end here. I encourage you to keep exploring, keep questioning, and most of all, keep sharing your stories. If today's conversation spoke to you, please pass it on. And if you have a story of your own you'd like to showcase, I am here and ready to listen. You can find all past and future episodes at selfmagnitude.com/podcast. And until next time, remember this, your voice matters.